Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, coming up, our first guest warns that the biggest danger facing the world is the threat of nuclear war. We'll find out why in a moment. And later, we'll discuss President Trump's planned announcement that he'll move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The move has caused outrage in the Middle East, especially with U.S. allies like Turkey and Jordan. We'll speak with an Israeli peace activist in a few minutes. Our first guest today, though, is Dr. Helen Caldicott, who is a pediatrician, co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and a longtime opponent of both nuclear weapons and nuclear power. She's the editor of a new book called Sleepwalking to Armageddon, in which she and other experts on nuclear weapons say that the greatest threat to the world is nuclear war. With tensions high between the U.S. and North Korea, proxy wars in the Middle East, and the ongoing hostility between Pakistan and India, Caldicott says the danger is real. Dr. Helen Caldicott has visited the Tampa Bay area several times in recent years, including doing a speech for WMNF and receiving an award from the Southwest Florida Coalition for Peace and Justice, after which she and I went to a karaoke bar where she sang Waltzing Matilda. I spoke with Dr. Helen Caldicott earlier this month. Dr. Helen Caldicott, welcome to WMNF. I know it's early there in Australia, but thanks for getting up and talking with us.
Thank you.
I want to ask you about why you wrote the book.
I read an article in the Atlantic Monthly quoting Stephen Hawking et al. About the fact that artificial intelligence could be so sophisticated within 10 years that computers could start a nuclear war with no human input. And I thought, oh my God, I'd better do something about this. So I held a symposium at the New York Academy of Medicine titled The Impending Threat of Nuclear War, and I got Max Tegmark, who is one of Hawking's colleagues, to speak, plus a whole lot of leading scientists, thinkers, politicians and the like from around the country and indeed the world. And so this book, Sleepwalking to Armageddon, is the proceeds for that symposium with an introduction by me.
So right now, even before artificial intelligence gets to that point, how hard do you think it would be to start a nuclear war?
Oh, simple. I mean, Trump could do it this minute. He's got the football with the nuclear codes in it. He's the only one in America who has the authority to start a nuclear war. It would take him about 3 minutes, and that's it. Bob's your uncle. That's it.
There's no intervening. He wouldn't have to go to Congress to get a declaration of war, or wouldn't have to ask his generals if they thought it was a wise move. He could just, if he wanted to, say, we're launching, and they would have to...
Yes, he could, because that's the law. Congress people are worried about him, and they've held hearings in the last week or two to see if they can pass the law to say Congress has to initiate it, not him. But it didn't pass. There's no law to say that has to happen. And the generals, McMaster and the others who are around him, they say they babysit him. They watch him very carefully. But, you know, the bloke doesn't need much sleep. He sleeps about 4 hours a night and wakes up early and starts tweeting, and he's always got the football with him. And so anything could happen.
Now, there's a new quote out from National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster. BuzzFeed first reported it, in which they talked to four people who were at a dinner where McMaster was speaking. It was a private dinner. And this McMaster allegedly called President Trump an idiot and a dope with the intelligence of a kindergartner.
Yep.
Have you heard about this?
Yes, I have. Yes, he did. He doesn't deny it.
So the president, apparently, from the reporting, is pretty wild mood swings. We saw him in the campaign trail where he would tell people to shut up or get out of here or beat him up. He had all sorts of words when he was speaking from the podium to protesters who were disagreeing with him. He seemed to be pretty hot-headed.
Yep, he is. He's temperamental, volatile, hot-headed, juvenile, takes it out on people. He's a bully and abuses women. I don't think he's ever read a book in his life. He knows nothing about international politics, let alone American politics. It's like Chauncey Gardner in Being There. Did you ever see that film?
I did see the film.
Yeah, and he didn't. He was, his IQ was very low, and wasn't he the president? And he, I mean, it was extraordinary. But this is worse. This is much worse.
Yeah, the book,
you couldn't even write a film about this or a book. It's just so extraordinary. It's beyond the limits of imagination.
It was a great book by Jerzy Kosinski, and then made into a film starring Peter Sellers. But don't you think that the military, though, would intervene? Wouldn't the generals, looking at the president, if McMaster did say this about the president, that he's got the intelligence of a kindergartner, wouldn't the generals intervene and say, look, this isn't going to happen, it doesn't make sense
to
launch...
Well, I can't, you see, because he's got the nuclear codes, and he would communicate directly with the commander of the Strategic Air Command. Now, he testified in Congress in the last week or so to the congressman who asked that very question, and he said, well, you know, it's my responsibility to respond to the commander-in-chief and follow his orders. But he said, I'm not stupid, he said, and if the order comes through that's stupid, I won't do it. That was the first time that anyone's ever said anything like that. But on the whole, he said he'd have to follow through on the orders. That's the way your stupid laws are written and your constitution since the nuclear age began. It's just ridiculous. So, you know, the guys that wired the world up like an atomic time bomb ready to go off any second gave the responsibility to one man to decide whether or not to blow up the planet.
The U.S. and Russia have come close, and the U.S. and the Soviet Union have come close, according to your book, Sleepwalking to Armageddon. We've come close in the past where there have been false reports of the other side launching nuclear weapons or launching an attack, a nuclear attack, on us or on them. Could you talk about how close we've come in the past?
Well, I got to know Robert McNamara quite well some years before he died. He was the Secretary of Defense under JFK, and he was in the Oval Office during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he said to me, Helen, you don't know how close we came to within 3 minutes. 3 minutes. There was another situation during the Cuban Missile Crisis where a man, and I think he was called, I can't remember his name, there's a Russian in a nuclear submarine, got a message that America had launched, and his obligation was to launch his missiles. Form his superiors. He just had a sense that it wasn't so. He didn't tell his superiors and he didn't launch. And the film has been made about him called The Man Who Saved the World. Another time someone plugged a War Games tape into the computer in the Pentagon, which took it seriously and was just preparing to start a nuclear war. Another time a flock of geese and another time a rising moon set off the satellites thinking that Russia had launched missiles. Another time, America launched a weather satellite from Norway, just where the Trident submarines roam, just near Russia. And they'd warned the Kremlin, but the Russians lost the warning. And so the Russians picked up the missile going up, and they thought that the Americans were going to decapitate, I like that word, decapitate Moscow and destroy Putin so he can't press his button. Oh no, it wasn't Putin, it was Yeltsin. Yeltsin, a hardened alcoholic, was sitting before his computer with three generals standing over his shoulder, and he had 3 minutes to decide, and they kept saying, Mr. President, press that button. And 1 minute before the end of that 3 minutes elapsed, the missile turned course and flew in another direction and they closed the computer. Now that's just a few. That's just a few. But there are many such instances such that I do not understand how we are still here.
We're talking with Dr. Helen Caldicott, one of the world's leading spokespeople for the anti-nuclear movement. She was a co-founder of Physicians for Social Responsibility, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2003. She's the editor of a new book called Sleepwalking to Armageddon, The Threat of Nuclear Annihilation. So in all those cases, we did avoid nuclear war. Doesn't that show that there are safety points, checkpoints in the nuclear chain that ultimately would prevent some sort of catastrophe?
No, just sheer bloody luck. Reminds me of when I worked in casualty years ago, an old man came in, he was 82 or something, and he'd had a car accident and broken his neck. He said, "I've been driving for 60 years and I've never had an accident." Well, he had an accident that night and broke his neck. Yeah, that doesn't prove a thing to say that we haven't had one. It's just sheer chance. And you know how fallible human beings are. I mean, president could get a brain tumor and do something just terribly dangerous, or develop acute psychosis overnight. I've had patients who've developed, normal, sane men who've developed acute psychosis. We're fallible. We're fallible. And we've harnessed the power inside the center of the sun. And we've got these things all over the planet ready to go with a flick of the wrist.
There's that word sleepwalking in the title of your book. In the 1960s and again in the 1980s, there was a strong movement to try to limit nuclear weapons. And in the last few years, that movement, and apologies to you, but that movement, with the exception of your group, has been pretty silent. Do you think that in the interim, things have gotten more dangerous since the last big push to reduce nuclear weapons in the 1980s?
Well, because when the Cold War ended, everyone thought, thank God, that's it. And they started talking about the peace dividend and transferring money for really good causes. And we were so tired and so exhausted, we thought, okay, they'll get rid of the weapons. Well, they didn't. None of the presidents did. They reduced them but didn't get rid of them. And so the threat that was hanging over our heads seemed to abate, but it didn't. And it remained the same. And the weapons are on hair trigger alert, as they've always been. And the men in missile silos operate the missiles with three hydrogen bombs on each missile, with floppy disks in the computers, and the telephones don't always work. And so everyone's gone to sleep thinking the danger's gone. I'm nearly 80, so I'm sort of moving out soon. shuffling off the mortal coil,
well,
I suppose.
Let's hope it doesn't happen too soon. I mean,
you never know. Anyway, but so people are sleepwalking. They're totally unaware of the danger which threatens them. It's quite extraordinary, really. Quite extraordinary.
There's so many interesting stories in your book, but one factoid in your book is that in these underground missile silos here in the U.S., you mentioned the floppy disks, that they communicate via floppy disk, which is so old-fashioned. I think there's an effort to try to upgrade that. But also, the military staff inside these missile silos, do they have guns to shoot each other if the other person is acting oddly?
There are two young men, aged like 18 to 23, in each missile silo, each armed with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. Well, obviously, the deviant one could shoot the other one. The mechanism to launch the missile, there are two locks 12 feet apart into which you insert a key and you both simultaneously turn the key. But they've worked out that one man can turn both locks by tying a string on the other key and turning both locks.
Hmm.
In the past few years, about 78 men have been sacked, fired, because they've been taking drugs, they go to sleep down there, they leave safety doors open. A couple of their commanders have been dismissed for very deviant, aberrant behaviour, betting and gaming and losing money and cavorting with naughty women in Moscow and that sort of thing. And they're all fallible. I do not know. I do not understand how we are still here. And I'm speaking now as a physician used to gathering all the data and the facts and working up the prognosis for a patient.
Dr. Caldicott, I want to ask you about what would happen if there was a small nuclear exchange. Let's say that India and Pakistan got into a nuclear war, or if North Korea was firing nuclear weapons at South Korea. Would the rest of the world be able to say, well, that's just a limited nuclear exchange, we have nothing to worry about here?
It would create the most intense international anxiety, which is sort of a platform to launch the whole global Holocaust. North Korea can blow up a single city. Only Russia and America can destroy life on the planet. They're the real terrorists. They actually are terrorists of the most profound variety. So North Korea could, you know, blow up Seoul or Tokyo, which would be awful. How America reacts would be another question. I mean, they might, as Donald Trump suggested, fire and fury, or what was it, something and fury, blow up the whole of North Korea and kill 25 million people. Now, if India and Pakistan went for it, they've both got, well, I think Pakistan's got nearly 200 bombs now, and India's got about 120. They would not only kill millions and millions and millions of their people, but they would create nuclear autumn. So much smoke and debris would be lofted into the stratosphere. It would block out the sun in the northern hemisphere to such a degree that crops would fail for about 10 years. It's called nuclear autumn, and millions, billions, 2 billion would die. Whereas if Russia and America both launched, they would create such a pall of smoke in the stratosphere that the sun would be blocked up for 10 years, creating a short ice age, and everything and everyone would freeze to death in the dark.
Dr. Caldicott, we only have a minute left. What gives you hope? Is there any leader of any nation who has nuclear weapons who's trying to lead the effort to reduce the possibility of their use and reduce the number of weapons? 16,000 nuclear warheads around the world. Is there any reason to have hope?
I think Macron has intimated something like that, but he's the only one.
So are you pretty pessimistic?
Unless America takes the lead, no one will, because she's the one that's led the arms race every step of the way. And everyone's emulated America, copied and followed. So unless America decides to behave in a responsible fashion, we're probably doomed. I hate to say that. But
Do you think President...
Everyone should think about that at Thanksgiving. What?
Do you think President Putin has a pretty sober view of nuclear weapons?
Yes, very sober. They lost 27 million people, don't forget, in the Second World War. The Second World War was won on the Russian front. I can remember my mother, I was only a little girl, 3 maybe, in the kitchen saying, thank God we're saved, he's turned on Russia, he'll never defeat Russia.
Well, Dr. Helen Caldicott, thanks a lot. The book is Sleepwalking to Armageddon. Helen, it's great to have you back on WMNF.
Thank you. I wish I could have sung Waltzing Matilda.
Well, next time you come to Tampa, you've got to sing Waltzing Matilda with us. Thanks, doctor. Well, that was Dr. Helen Caldicott, a pediatrician from Australia. Her latest book is Sleepwalking to Armageddon. She's been a longtime critic of nuclear weapons. And you are listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm Rob Lori. President Trump is expected to make a speech at 1 o'clock this afternoon announcing a major change in U.S. policy toward Israel, moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. Leaders of major Christian denominations in the Holy Land have appealed to President Trump to rethink his expected decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. They say in a letter that Trump's steps will mean increased hatred, conflict, violence, and suffering in Jerusalem and the Holy Land. Their letter asks Trump to walk toward more love and a definitive peace by continuing to recognize the international status of Jerusalem. President Trump's expected declaration of Jerusalem as Israel's capital later today is likely to send shockwaves across the region by ending longtime U.S. policy on one of the core issues in the decades-long Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Jerusalem is home to major Jewish, Christian, and Muslim holy sites, and previous moves seen as altering Jerusalem's status have ignited violent protests. Our next guest is a veteran of the Israeli military. He's an Israeli peace activist who spends his time now between Jerusalem and San Diego. His grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Israel and signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father was a general and a member of the parliament. He's lost a family member to terrorism. He writes about his family and what it was like growing up in Israel in his memoir, The General's Son. And he joins us right now. His name is Miko Peled. And Miko, welcome to WMNF. Great to have you here. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
So I want to ask you about what's expected to be announced by President Trump this afternoon, that the U.S. is in favor of moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that it's a careless, reckless, actually, move. It's a reckless declaration. Jerusalem, I was born and raised in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem, until about 7 decades ago, Jerusalem was a Muslim Arab city for 1,500 years. Now, much of it still is Muslim and Arab, but over the last 7 decades, which has been since the existence of the State of Israel, Israel has conquered the entire city, has been involved in a very brutal, very violent campaign of de-Arabizing, in other words, getting rid of the Palestinian Arab population and pushing in Jewish population into it, so as to change the demographics and to try to change the nature of the city. The initial conquest of the first half of the city, which was done in 1948, was never recognized because it contravenes international law and it contravenes common sense. And in 1967, when the second part, the eastern part of the city, was conquered, that too had not been recognized. Israel, of course, calls it the capital of the State of Israel, but nobody's recognized it because it has been a consistently Arab and Muslim city and continues to be, in nature, a Muslim city, and people aren't willing to recognize the violent takeover of the city by the State of Israel. Now, this goes in the face of the entire Muslim world. This is not just limited to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. The entire Muslim world sees Jerusalem as a holy city, and recognizing this very brutal conquest and forced population change is a very, very serious mistake.
How do you think the Arab community is going to respond based on, if you know, the Palestinian people that you know who live in Jerusalem, based on what you know about them, how do you think they might receive this announcement this afternoon?
Well, I think people are very, very concerned. I think this is recognizing this is a game changer internationally. It's a game changer diplomatically. It completely changes the nature of the relations between the U.S. and, like I said, the entire Muslim world, and certainly the U.S. In regards to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Now, Palestinians living in Jerusalem live under very, very strict laws imposed upon them by the State of Israel. Jerusalem, they have a special ID called a Jerusalem ID, which recognizes them as merely being like alien residents. They don't really have a citizenship, even though some of the families, or most of the families, Palestinian families in Jerusalem, go back, you know, hundreds and hundreds, some over 1,000 years. Whereas I was born and raised in Jerusalem, I have full citizenship. I can come and go as I please. Palestinians are always at risk of losing their residency and losing their property there. I think people are scared. I think people don't know what to expect. Living as a Palestinian in Jerusalem means you're under threat all the time, either by settlers to be kicked out of your home, or by laws that the State of Israel is imposing, or by realigning the city and changing the city's boundaries, and so forth. So because that affects the rights of the Palestinians, their ability to travel, and the right to be in the city. I think people are scared. I mean, the last time there was an issue with Jerusalem, when Israel tried to place metal detectors on for worshippers to go into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, there was massive civil disobedience, and they won. In other words, the Israelis had to take away the metal detectors and all the security apparatus that they were trying to force Palestinians to go through. Who knows what Palestinians are going to do? I mean, this is a population that has been under the gun and under very, very restrictive laws for a very long time now. And who knows what's going to happen? But I think the bigger picture here, again, is this comes in the face of the entire Muslim community, the entire Muslim world. I mean, this is going to affect the relations between not just, like I said, Israelis and Palestinians, but the U.S. and the entire Muslim world, because this is an ancient and holy Muslim city.
We're talking with Mikko Peled. He's the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and he's an Israeli peace activist. He's a veteran of the Israeli military. Our phone number, 813-239-9663. What do you say to the conservative supporters of Prime Minister Netanyahu who say that the Palestinians have not been willing to negotiate? They've been unwilling peace partners, and Israel has extended its hands many times to try to create peace with the Palestinians and resolve this situation. Is that an accurate or a fair way to describe what's gone on in the last since 1948?
No, that's a complete mischaracterization of what has happened. Whoever says that needs to take a close look at history and perhaps read different sources. The Palestinians have gone out of their way, particularly over the last 30 years, to demonstrate and to be willing to end the conflict and bring Israelis and Palestinians to a place where they're able to live in peace as normal human beings should. Israel has not been willing, has not shown any willingness whatsoever to do this. And every time Israel comes back and it takes more land and more land and more land, and this new deal now that Donald Trump is talking about, talks about giving the Palestinians or allowing the Palestinians to establish a state in what is considered Area A, which is a small fraction of the West Bank, which in itself is a small fraction of all of historic Palestine, and then the Gaza Strip, which is a joke. The entire country is Palestine, and Palestinians should have rights, and their rights should be recognized over the entire country. So it's not true. Israel has not shown any desire, any willingness to make peace with the Palestinians, and has not shown any willingness to even stop its expansion into Palestinian land and taking of Palestinian homes. You know, in Jerusalem alone, I believe there are 15,000 Palestinian homes that are under demolition order today. The reality of Palestinians, even as we speak, day by day, over the entire country, Palestinians are being kicked out of their homes, their lands are being taken, they're being denied water. Never mind, 2 million people in Gaza have been denied water for years now, living under siege. So there's a very, very severe reality that all Palestinians have been living under. And I think what's interesting is that, by and large, Israel has been allowed to pretty much do as it wills. And as it wills in regards to Palestinians, the issue of Jerusalem is a red line beyond a red line. In other words, this is a place where even Muslim countries that do business with Israel and have relations with Israel are standing up and saying this is something that we cannot and will not tolerate.
When you say the 15,000 homes are under demolition order, is there due process for the Palestinian people whose homes are threatened with destruction?
They can appeal, but by and large, in some cases they can appeal. But by and large, because these are secure, they all come under security issues. They really have no recourse. The army always wins. The security forces always win. And so they can try to go and use the Israeli court system. The Israeli court system will not heed their request or their to stop this. And the thing is, people have to go on and live their life knowing that at some point at 2 o'clock in the morning, the Israeli army is going to show up with bulldozers and destroy their homes. And this is well known that it's part of an ongoing process to what they call Judaize and de-Arabize the city of Jerusalem. In other words, in a very violent way to change the nature of the city. So again, recognizing that and recognizing that this is the capital of the state of Israel is a recognition of such brutality and such violence that in a place that is so sensitive and where the status quo has been held religiously for so long that it's an absolutely reckless move on the part of Donald Trump.
We're talking with Mikko Paled, who's an Israeli peace activist. So, Mikko, who benefits or who is cheering the president's announcement today?
I believe it's the. I think it's nobody. Nobody benefits. I mean, the state of Israel would like to have that recognition because the state of Israel likes to win and then believes that that Jerusalem should be recognized. But there's no actual benefit to it. There are no embassies, and nobody else is going to do this. I think this has a lot to do with the relationship between Donald Trump and his son-in-law and the Kushner family and the Kushner Foundation, which have been donating millions and millions of dollars to settlements and then have strong interests, political and ideological, with the state of Israel. I don't think this has anything to do with benefiting U.S. National security or U.S. Interests in the region. Quite the opposite. I think this is a very narrow-minded and short-sighted move. Nobody gains to benefit anything from this except for the state of Israel, which wishes to expand throughout all of Palestine and have its expansion recognized.
Mikko, I mentioned earlier that I've heard from people who say that Israel has extended its hand and offered peace over the last 60 or 70 years since 1948. Let me bring on one of the callers who says that. It's Simon Lakeland, who has lived in Israel, and he's one of our frequent callers. Simon, welcome to WMNF. What's your question for Mikko Paled?
Hi, thank you very much. Simon from Lakeland. First of all, what I would say is don't believe what I say. I would recommend that the people who are truly interested in the subject go to the Yale Library. It's called the Avalon Project, which is a digitized library that will actually bring up transcripts of the 1937 Peel Commission, the 1946 Anglo Commission. And people such as the quintessential historian, Philip Hitte, who said there was no such entity as Palestine. Now, on your guess, which is really a waste of time. And I will tell you why Mikko is a waste of time, because he has compared Israel to Nazi Germany. He has also recently been disavowed as an anti-Semite at a seminar in Princeton by the Jewish Voices for Peace through his Twitter. He associates himself with Ilan Pappe, who has come out, and I would be very much to quote, that he's not interested in that.
Okay,
ideology.
Well, Simon, you've leveled a lot of charges there. Let me get Mikko to respond. And Simon, thanks a lot. Thanks for your call. Great to hear from you, Mikko. What would you say back? Lots of attacks there. What would you say?
Well, I don't think the purpose of this interview is to respond to nonsense like this. These are personal attacks that absolutely have no bearing on reality.
Well, okay, so he says there was no entity as Palestine, and if you look back at the Avalon Project, which he cites, and I have not looked at the Avalon Project myself, but there is no such entity as Palestine.
Well, he can say it all day long. When the United Nations decided to partition Palestine in November of 1947, it was called the Partition of Palestine. In 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was given, where the British government basically promised to make Palestine a homeland for the Jews, they called it Palestine. If you walk into Monticello in Thomas Jefferson's house here in Virginia, and you take a look at the foyer, there's a big map that his father drew because his father was a cartographer. And it's a big map of Africa, and just north and east of Africa, there's a big stretch of land, and it says in big, bold letters, Palestine. So to say that there was no such thing as Palestine is ignorance. I mean, I don't know, there's no other way to describe it. Of course there was a Palestine. The Palestinian people are Palestinians. The Palestinians who are living in refugee camps for the last seven decades are called Palestinians. The entire world calls them Palestinians. The only place in the world where people refuse to recognize or still claim that there was no such thing as Palestine are some people in Israel and some people here in the U.S. who follow this ideology. But it's sheer ignorance to say that there was no Palestine. I don't even know where that comes from.
I was reading an article about American support, Jewish American support for moving the embassy. And I got this from the American Jewish Committee. In September, they released a report saying 44% of American Jews do not support the U.S. President Trump's suggestion of moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. The survey by the AJC, which is conducted every year, was based on telephone interviews carried out in August, incorporating a national sample of 1,000 American Jews aged 18 and over. 9% were Orthodox, 16% identified with the conservative movement, 31% were Reform, 2% were Reconstructionists, and 39% considered themselves just Jewish. 36% of the survey's respondents said that they would be in favor of the embassy's relocation only in conjunction with a clear progress in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. That's from the American Jewish Committee. So is it a small group of people who support Israel who want this move?
Yes, this is like I said, it's an irresponsible move, and anybody who cares about the region and anybody cares about U.S. policy and U.S. interests and anybody cares about world peace has to oppose this. And the interesting thing is this has nothing to do with Jews. I mean, I'm sure you're familiar. There's a very large community of ultra-Orthodox Jews who live in Jerusalem and live in New York and around the world who have been opposing the state of Israel and who are opposing and have been putting out statement after statement after statement. These are the most Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox religious Jews. And tens of thousands of them have been protesting and have been coming on the streets in New York and in Jerusalem against this move because they know this will bring nothing but violence. This will bring nothing but recognition to something that should not be recognized, which is the violent takeover by the state of Israel of the city of Jerusalem. And there's no religious aspect to this that's favorable. There's no political aspect to this that's favorable. There's no security aspect to this that's favorable. It is a whim that Donald Trump has in his head. Again, I believe because of his connection to the Kushner family, who represent a very radical right-wing policies and thinking regarding the state regarding Israel and Palestine. And this is the only reason he's doing it. It is careless. It is reckless. And God, we should only hope that it won't bring about violence, but whatever response comes out will be like the last time the Palestinians responded in Jerusalem, which was massive civil disobedience.
Well, I want to ask you about the Christian connection to supporting President Trump. Why do you think so many evangelical Christians who are on the conservative side support making Jerusalem the capital of Israel? That seems to be one of the bases of support for President Trump in this move. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it comes from the same kind of ideology that believes that Jews are somehow superior to others, and that by allowing the Jews to take over Palestine, they are, bringing some kind of, the hastening the end of the world and the second coming and all kinds of theories like that. It has nothing to do with the well-being of the people. It has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing to do with the political situation. Again, it has nothing to do with benefiting the people who actually live there. This is only recognizing some kind of a messianic, theology. But again, when we look at the most Orthodox community in Jerusalem, of the most Orthodox Jewish community, and of course, if you talk to Christians and Muslims in Jerusalem, they will all oppose it. They all oppose this move completely and entirely because they recognize exactly how dangerous this is.
We're talking with Mikko Peled. He's a veteran of the Israeli military. He's an Israeli peace activist. He spends part of his time in Israel, part of his time here in the U.S. His grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Israel and signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father was a general and a member of the Israeli Knesset. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. We don't hear much about the situation with the Palestinians and in Israel, except when there's some sort of violence. Could you tell me what the status is of the peace movement that involves both Israelis and Palestinians? Is there much of a peace movement today in which those groups work together?
Not much, no. There's very little, in fact. I mean, on the Palestinian side, there are countless groups and countless efforts and countless initiatives to really oppose the expansion of the state of Israel into Palestinian land, whether it's in what used to be the West Bank, whether it's in the Galilee, whether it's in the Negev Desert, I mean, whether it's in Jerusalem, because this is going on over the entire country. On the Israeli side, there's very, very little. It's a small group of people it's a negligent number. Who show up and try to participate in events and try to participate in any kinds of actions to oppose what the state of Israel is doing. And I think, you know, Israelis vote by very large numbers. I think if people want to know what Israelis think, then we look at the results of the election. And in the last election, Netanyahu won by what is considered, in Israeli terms, a landslide. And his polls and his numbers are very strong. Even with all the corruption charges, he's still very strong. And when we look at the makeup of the rest of the Israeli Knesset, the rest of the Israeli, you know, political world, on the issue of Palestine, the differences are very, very slight. And so even if somebody else was to take his place in terms of the policy towards the Palestinians, we there's no reason to expect any change. So that was a phenomenon that lasted a very short time, and it's all but gone. I mean, there's a few small groups that still function and try to work together, but the main work now is on the Palestinian side in different parts of the country, trying to really just to survive, trying to make sure that they get running water and that the settlers don't come in and take their land and kick them out of their homes or beat up their children, and of course settlers are usually accompanied by soldiers who protect the settlers and support them, whether it's in Hebron, again, whether it's in the Negev Desert in the southern part of the country, where tens of thousands of citizens of the state of Israel who are Palestinians are denied services, denied water, denied electricity, denied health care, and so forth. So the situation is very, very severe. And you're right, we don't hear about this. Nothing is ever mentioned unless there's some kind of violence, unless there's something extreme or outrageous that takes place. And this is allowing the very slow and methodical creeping of these very, very radical Israeli policies against the Palestinians to go on unmentioned and almost undetected.
Well, we're talking about President Trump's expected announcement this afternoon that he wants to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. And the impending announcement is causing shockwaves around the world. Let's go to Andrew in Hardy County. Andrew, what's your question for Mikko Peled?
Yeah, thanks so much for putting this broadcast on today, Rob and Nico. Thanks so much for getting the real story out. I want to just quickly raise a couple of points. I'd love to hear his response, because there are going to be consequences for this madness. Two things. One, on the whole, there is no Palestine. Anybody who knows anything about the history of the Ottoman Empire understands what was going on in the Middle East and the Balkans at that period of time. And that's a large part of what that nonsense is based on. Well, it was the Ottoman Empire. There was no Palestine. It's nonsense. There were Palestinian houses, Palestinian streets, Palestinian people, Palestinian culture, Palestinian food. It was Palestine. All right? It was part of the Ottoman Empire. It was Palestine. All right? And this whole thing about saying there's no nation, it's kind of like saying, well, there was no Cherokee Nation, or there was no Sioux Nation, or there was no Apache Nation, because, you know, they didn't have a parliament, they didn't have a Congress, they didn't have a Supreme Court.
And Andrew, I don't mean to cut you off, but do you have a question for Mikko?
Yeah. My basic question is, what does he think is going to happen over the course of the next 8 to 10 years in terms of response from some of the more active components of Islamic response to the United States? Because this is an action by the United States. We've gotten responses before, and I'd love to hear what he thinks the response parallel to, for instance, 9/11 might turn out to be.
All right, Andrew, thanks a lot. Thanks for your question. Mikko?
I agree with his historical, the bit of history that he reminded us all of. It's very true. In terms of response, who knows how people are going to respond? I mean, the Muslim world is very diverse, and it's very large, and it expands over a very large part of the globe. So who knows what the response is going to be? But there's no question that there's going to be responses. There's no question that this is Trump giving the middle finger, excuse me, to the entire Muslim world. And for no benefit. In other words, there's not even any benefit to the United States or anybody by doing this. In terms of what's going to happen, I believe in the next 10 years or so, I mean, the Palestinian population is growing faster than the Jewish population over the entire country, over all of the country, whether you call it Israel or Palestine. And eventually, there's going to be a movement forcing the state of Israel to change from a Jewish state to the state of all of its citizens. And I believe it's inevitable. I think it's going to be a good thing. It's going to turn Israel into a real democracy, so Palestinians and Israelis will have equal rights. And I believe that that's something we should all be looking forward to and, in fact, fighting for.
So do you think that does this move by President Trump make a two-state solution far less probable because of the position the president is taking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the two-state solution has been dead for many, many, many years. Israel killed it because there is no more West Bank. Israel destroyed this area within Palestine, within the country that used to be called the West Bank. It no longer exists. It is completely a part of Israel, except for a few pockets that have been that have been completely segregated and are wholly Palestinian. And so there is no possibility of a two-state solution. The only possibility is continuing the way things are now, where Israel controls the entire country and Palestinians, even though they make up close to the, I mean, they're just about the majority of the population, are living in extreme segregation and without rights and without access to water. And I think that's there's an inevitability here that is going to fall apart and make way for a real democracy. I think that's where things are going. So even talking about the two-state solution at this point, regardless of this reckless move by Trump, is really a waste of time, because there is no possibility, and Israel did everything it could already to destroy the possibility of the establishment of a Palestinian state. And quite frankly, you know, many Palestinians live outside of those areas that used to be like the West Bank. You know, many of them live in other parts of the country. It doesn't, you know, the Palestinians live in Jerusalem and so forth. So that solution there was a very short period of time where that solution may have been viable, but Israel very quickly made it an impossibility. And here we are today with some 12 million people living in that country. Palestinians make up a little bit over half of the population. And Donald Trump wants to recognize one of the most ancient Muslim Arab cities in the Arab world as the capital of the state of Israel. And that is outrageous. It is absolutely outrageous and reckless.
So you're saying that if Israel holds on to all the territory that it acquired in 1967 and still maintains, and the people within that area include Palestinians and Arabs, that eventually Israel is going to have to come to terms with, what does it do with these citizens? Does it extend them full democratic rights, or does it treat them as second-class citizens?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, Israel established a reality where the entire country is one state governed by one government, which is the government of Israel. Now, people like myself have full rights. We have full privileges. We live in a reality, though we were living here in the U.S. or in Europe, you know, completely kind of liberal democracy with rights and so forth. Palestinians live under completely different laws. They have less access to resources. They have very little access to water. And access to movement and so on and so forth. I mean, the laws that govern the lives of Palestinians are such a complicated web of laws, you would need 10 law degrees to even begin to understand it.
When we think of democracies, we think of people within that democracy, everybody having the same rights. Prime Minister Netanyahu says that Israel is one of the few democracies in this part of the world. Is Israel a true democracy right now?
Israel is only a democracy if you're a Jew. If you're an Israeli Jew, then you live in a democracy. If you're a citizen of the state of Israel that is not a Jew, then you live in an entirely different reality, an entirely different set of laws, under different sets of laws completely. You have different, and it goes not just to the laws, it goes to things like access to water, for example. You know, all the water in the country is governed by Mikorot, which is the Israeli Water Authority. Palestinians are allocated 3% of the water, for example. You know, so I mean, there are things that are so inherently undemocratic within the state of Israel, besides the laws that govern the daily life of the Palestinians. And again, depending on where they live, where Palestinians reside, that will determine the types of laws under which they live and the type of limited rights that they might have. So if they're Israeli citizens, they get certain laws. If they're a Jerusalem resident, they're different laws. If they live in what used to be in the cities that used to be the West Bank, then it's military law. So it's a very complicated web, but it's definitely not a democracy unless you're an Israeli Jew. If you're an Israeli Jew, then it's true, Israel is a democracy. But Israeli Jews make up today just about less than just a little bit less than half the population. So it is not a democracy by any stretch of the imagination.
Let's go to Ken in St. Petersburg. Ken, you're on the air with Miko Peled. What's your question?
Just a quick comment. Thank you for the show, first of all, Rob. And thank you for taking control when Simon got on and not letting him hijack the show. I want to thank your guest for his knowledge and his courage speaking about this. I also wanted to mention Sami Haddawi had written a lot on land issues in that area. He was born there in 1904 in Jerusalem, Christian parents, and he died at 100 years old. And he actually worked for the UN for a while. But also Chomsky, I mean, Noam Chomsky, and the Journal of Palestine Studies back over 30 years ago started writing about these water issues, how the water and other resources were being withheld from non-Jews, basically. And thank you for a great show.
All right, Ken, thanks for your comments. And Miko, we had a question about the boycott and divestment and sanctions movement. What do you think of the movement?
Well, I think it is absolutely the right thing at the right time. It is morally justifiable. It is dedicated. It's persistent. It has a track record. It's been working very, very well. Although, in the context of Palestine, it's still a bit, things are moving slow, but it has had some very good successes. And I think all people of conscience need to support the boycott, divestment, and sanctions or the BDS movement and do everything they can to strengthen it, because that is the tool by which Israel will change from a non-democratic state into a democracy with equal rights, I believe. I think that is the process by which we will achieve that.
Isn't Israel, though, under attack? I mean, we hear from supporters of Israel say, you know, it's always got to be on guard. Hamas is out to attack Israel. Iran is out to attack Israel. This is what the supporters of the prime minister say. Israel has to take a hard line. It has to be vigilant. Never again. The Israeli people say we don't want to, we want this homeland to be protected. What would you say?
Yeah, well, first of all, I go back to the BDS for a second, because I think these two questions are connected. You know, the objective or the set goal of the call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which came from Palestinian civil society about 10 years ago, are to end the military occupation of lands that were taken in 1967, which is something that there's an international consensus over, it has been for a very long time. The second demand is equal rights for Palestinians with Israeli Jews, which is something that I don't know how you can argue against. I mean, equal rights is a very basic foundation of any democracy. And the right of the Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and their land. And again, this is something that's been enshrined in international law. There's a UN resolution calling for it and so forth. So these are very, 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 very moderate, very reasonable demands. Israel tries to turn everything into terrorism, tries to turn everything into an attack. Iran is attacking them, although there's absolutely no evidence to that effect. Hamas is a resistance organization. Hamas would never have been created had there not been an occupation and oppression of the Palestinian people. Hamas, in its very name, is called the Islamic Resistance Movement. It is a resistance movement, and as a resistance movement, it was created as a response to the oppression, to the occupation. So, of course, when you have oppression and you have an occupation, you're going to have people fighting against you. That's the reality. That's how people are. But it's not that we have to find out what was the created the resistance. Why is there the oppression? The oppression is the problem. The occupation is the problem. The lack of rights for Palestinians is the problem. And when you take away people's rights, you deny people rights, they will stand up. They will fight. And I have to say, in terms of the Palestinians, at least, the vast majority of their resistance has been unarmed. And again, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the BDS movement, has been stellar in this. I mean, it's an unarmed, nonviolent, dedicated movement that is calling for resistance through nonviolence, which is, I think, commendable.
Well, Miko Peled, we're out of time. Thank you so much for coming on WMNF. Do you have a website?
I do, mikopeled.com, MIKOPELED.com.
All right. Well, Miko, thanks a lot. We didn't get a chance to delve into some of the more important questions, too, including the history of your family. But maybe we could get you back.
Be happy to. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Miko. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye. That's Miko Paled, author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. His father was a general and a member of the parliament. His grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Israel and signed the Israeli Declaration of Independence. And he lost a family member to terrorism. Again, his book is The General's Son. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115. We'll play those comments back tomorrow at 11. Stay tuned because NOLA's coming up with the Midpoint program. You're listening to WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota.